Yes, October 16th, 2023. I want to begin just because after the class, one more thing about the Synagogue Council. I went back to Rabbi Wurzberger's article. Right after the Rav passed away, he wrote an article on Rav as Posek, postmodern orthodoxy in tradition. Rabbi Wurzberger was so close to the Rav, going back. Well, I have to find out if it's certainly the 50s, if not maybe the 40s. I don't know. I'll get the details later. I mean,
Probably
there
in
was a single
1940. Probably in
in the 40s.
1940,
Okay.
when he was a rabbi. But the rabbi said, I heard the rabbi's wife made the shidduch. He came to,
Yeah,
well,
he
he
was
came
a
to
single
Rock.
person. He
He was
used
a
to
single
eat with
guy.
the
He came
Rav.
to Roxbury, and he'd come to the rabbi's house for the Seder. And Mrs. Salvechik, with a girl there, said to, look, don't listen to everything my husband will say that the Kutcher Torah. You talk to this girl. She's a very
Yeah.
religious girl, and you talk to her. Husband, listen to this,
Uh-huh.
and everything. You talk to her. And he did. They got married.
Okay, so that's in the 40s.
That's
Very
the
good.
story that I
He
heard.
was Rabbi Chaye Adom, if you know the
Adom,
shul
that's right.
in
In
Boston.
Roxbury,
But so
Dorchester,
in his
Russell Square.
article, he writes that the first of all, the followers of the Rav did not belong to the transdenominational, sorry, the interdenominational rabbinic association, or the associated synagogues, which is a lay body of Orthodox and conservative Reform. And so, what about the synagogue council? The way Wurzberger says has it is that ideally he would have preferred that these organizations not come into existence. However, they already were in existence, the synagogue council and rabbis, I mean, organizations were involved with them, including the RCA, the OU, and therefore he thought that we should not pull out of it, that he thought it would be a divisive move. And he actually, Rabbi Wurzberger writes about this, was really the brains and the motivation behind the scenes in pushing the OU to remain in the synagogue council. I don't know if he pushed the same way to the RCA to remain in it, although the RCA did, but definitely the OU. And but again, that's not the New York Board of Rabbis or anything like that. I'm not sure why how we thread the needle or anything, but that's the rough. Now, last class, Mark. I don't know if he's back with us. Okay. He was quite shocked and surprised when I mentioned about shuls not duchening on Shabbos, Yom Tov that falls out on Shabbos. Now, I would like to know if there's anyone who goes to a shul that today does not duchen on Shabbos. I have not seen that in all the times I've been around, but this was not only a popular minhag, this might have been the dominant minhag in Rita, not to duchen when Shabbos came out, and it's completely disappeared, not because of the rock. Let me just give you some sources. And by the way, this is not a new minhag.
It's common in
The
Israel. And it's
you
common
can see
in
this
England.
minhag. Oops, hold on. I gotta.
It's common in England.
Oh, hold on. Sorry. You were saying so. Well, wait till Gersha. Wait till I'm done, and then you'll share it. Sorry. I'm going to show you something about England in a minute. The Taz. So this is taking back 4 years ago, already mentions that some communities have this minhag. He says, I don't know the reason. He says, I don't know any justification for it. The Magen Avraham also mentions this, and he tries to provide a justification, but he's not so happy with it. But I just was looking around a little bit, and I found there's a sefer from the 19th century, Lemberg, 1876, I think, called Halacha Ramosha by Rabbi Chiyo Hubner. If you look at it, it's Siman Mem Gimel, just to get a sense, not because he's the greatest Gadol Yisrael, but he testifies what things were like in Lita and Poland. He says, Hinei haminag barov tefutzos Yisrael, the minhag among most Jews in the diaspora, shebeyom tov shachar b'Shabbos Kodesh, ein hakohanim olim l'duchen. So he's telling you, he's writing in Poland, Lemberg, but we'll see the same in Lita. He says that most shuls, they don't duchen on Shabbos. How is it possible that a minhag that was the majority minhag, as far as I know, I can't find it anywhere, at least, unless people will start writing me in and correcting me and say, This is still the minhag in places. And then he quotes the Taz. He quotes Rav Yaakov Emden in his Siddur, who says Yaakov Emden sachak al zeh. He laughed about this, and he says that this is a minhag garua. It's a terrible minhag, but nevertheless he says uve emes nispashek eit minhag zeh bein kama tzadikim vachareim kol chagim. Okay, he says that this minhag has now become popular. And I think when he says it's spread among Kamat Sadikim, he means Chassidish Rebbis. And he gives justifications, he gives reasons for it. He thinks perhaps the reason is because there was a minhag that you would go, Kohanim would go to the mikvah the day they had to do Duchanim. And he says that since there's a problem going to, for men to go to the mikvah on Shabbos, although the Hasidim do that, but there is an issue, especially if it's a warm mikvah. He says that could have read the reason, been the reason why they stopped doing it. And he says, if enum nevim, but enum nevim heim, we know that if a minhag is spread among Kol Yisrael, it's you can sort of rely on it. Now, here's a book, Zichronos Hasridiyesh. It's put together all the biographical, autobiographical stuff from Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg by his student, Rabbi Weingort, and he also put in stuff, oral things that he has from growing up with Rabbi Weinberg. Incidentally, I sent in a new Sforim blog post a few weeks ago. I'm going to email the guy tomorrow, I think, to see what's doing with it. Because I assume with everything going on in Israel, it took them, everything's been pushed off. I was supposed to go to this university for a Shabbaton in 2 weeks, one of the big American universities, and I hadn't heard from them. And then I emailed, and as you can imagine, with all that's doing, especially in the college campus, they were not thinking about what's going to be at the Shabbaton. They didn't apply to raise money. You know, they have to deal with Hamas lovers marching on campus. You know, so the scholar in residence at the Shabbaton was the last thing on their mind. So I get it. But in this post, the first ever color pictures of Rabbi Chiel Yaakov Weinberg. No one's going to credit me. You'll see. All of a sudden, now these will be the standard pictures because there's some great close-ups and amazing pictures. But at least the people who read the Sforim blog will know that I found them. And I have other pictures I'm going to come out with later. I have other ones I have which have never been published, including going back to the 1920s. But what do we find here? In this book on page 167, he says that Rabbi Chayak of Weinberg, when he was in Montreux, Switzerland, he insisted, and he had a little shul that he was the rav on, that Kohanim are not allowed to duchen on Shabbos. Now, I know the rav said this is Amaratzos, but here you have the Sri Diesh, in the footnote here, he quotes the Mishnah Berurah, who, again, is very opposed to this, because all the textual sources... Maybe this is what Chaim Soloveitch is speaking about, the abandonment of the Mimetic culture. Every single post-sec you look at it, they all say this is nonsense. But the Mimetic culture said, well, we don't do it. So we've got Mimetic culture has disappeared. So he quotes, the Mishnah Berurah says that is against this so-called minhag. But Rabbi Meir Yust, who was the rabbi of Amsterdam, reports that Rabbi Weinberg told him, even in Rodin, the city of the Chavetz Chaim, the minhag was that they didn't do duchening the Siyas Kapayim on Shabbos, and even though the Chavetz Chaim tried to change it, he couldn't change it. Remember, the Chavetz Chaim was not the Rav of Radin. There was a Rav. The Rav of Radin was actually, during part of the time the Chavetz Chaim was there, it was the uncle of the Nazir, Rav David Cohen the Nazir. Now, I'm holding something here. Bit of a rare book, I think, today. Anyone still have this? I bet Rabbi Hartman must have it, maybe. This is the Solar Pool, the Solar Pool Siddur. The RCA thought that this would be a Siddur. It never took off. Birnbaum was a better Siddur, not to mention the fact that this is only for Shabbos and Yom Tov. If you're a shul, you don't want a Siddur only Shabbos and Yom Tov. You want a Siddur for the whole week. So it never
took off.
But I looked at it, and lo and behold, this is what it says, page 315. This is for the RCA shuls. During the repetition of the Musaf Amida, the Kohanim ascend the platform Duchen before the Ark to bless the congregation. The Duchen service is set on festivals that fall on weekdays. with the exception of Simchas Torah. So here you have this Siddur saying no duchening on Shabbos. And it gets better. And this maybe relates to what Gershon's going to report for us. I Googled it. And what did I find? Well, found an article here, Rabbi on a Narrow Bridge. He deals with duchening. He tells us that the Rutledge Siddur in England says you don't duchen on Yom Tov falls on Shabbos. He says the Hertz. Oh, I looked in the Hertz and I didn't see that. I have the Hertz. Doesn't say it, but the old Saks Korin, not the new one, but the old one. Here it is. On Yom Tov, except on Shabbos and Simchas Torah, the following Birkas Kohanim is added. So he points out that in the new Korin Machzor, they took this out. But they don't have on Shabbos. But the original Korin said that you don't duchen on Shabbos. So what can I tell you? It's a minhag. I don't know if there's any shuls in the world. If there are no shuls, if no one can testify to shuls today, don't do that. That's got to be one of the quickest turnarounds of minhag, something which was very popular, if not dominant, in Europe before the war. Today, at least, none of the shuls I've been to that I can recall do it. So if anyone has any reports, you can let me know. I'd love to know this. The next thing I want to mention, maybe two more things. We're close to the end, by the way. I think we might only have three more classes on the Rav's letters. I was surprised how fast, how much I progressed today in preparing for it. But this is also something. A couple of people were shocked, surprised. I mean, not at me. They're not doubting what I said. But what the idea that standard halacha, technically, according to the mainstream halacha, a kohen could be in the same room with a non-Jewish body. Now, granted, we're no way to be machner. I'll show you the lashon of the Shulchan Aruch. But people, some people at least, I never heard that. That was the basis of Rav Gorin's heter that, and Rav Yaakov Weinberg, that in pressing circumstances, we can rely on that the mainstream opinion. Here's the language of the Shulchan Aruch in Yoredeia. It's in Yoredeia, Shin Ayin Beis 2. That is the, it's better, and this is from the Maharam and Tosfos, it's better not to, you know, go on the graves of non-Jews. He doesn't say it's usser, it's better. And the Rama adds, afal pishayesh makil, and even though there are those who are mekel, nachon ohachmir, it's better to be machmir. And that's the halacha that we say that although even the Shulchan Aruch holds that technically it's permissible in his mind, but it's better not to, and therefore we don't. Unless there's like a tzorech, a real reason to. And so, for instance, I remember, I don't know what the name of this exhibit was. Some of you will type it in. Remember they had in New York all these like skeletons. I thought it was so spooky, such a strange thing. But there was this exhibit at the library. You go visit the skeletons. Everyone was saying Kohanim can't go. And that's correct. Kohanim can't go. However, let's say you worked at the museum. That was your job. Would you have to quit your job? No, you don't have to quit your job. Or let's say you had an interview one day there. I mean, that's a sorech, so you wouldn't have to. But just to go visit it, you don't do that. So where does this, where was this practical? Halacha Maisa also? Well, this, some of you might recognize this man here. Or here he is. If you go to London, one of the places to go as a tourist is University College, and you can go see Jeremy Bentham. There is Jeremy Bentham. What you'll see is Bentham's preserved skeleton dressed in his own clothes and surmounted by a wax head. Bentham requested that his body be preserved in this way in his will, made shortly before his death on June 6, 1832. So when I was in England for a whole year in Oxford, and I've been back many, many times, and it always has been part of my bucket list to go see Jeremy Bentham. But I've never made it around yet to see him. But there he is. Now, lo and behold, there's a tshuva sefer called Leib Aryeh by Rav Aryeh Leib Grossness. He was one of Dayanim on the London Beis Din. And he says the following question. This is in volume 2, number 15, Sima Tesavov. Nish'alnu mekohanim shein talmidei universita mesuyemas b'Anglia. I don't know why he's so ambiguous. He says, I was asked by students who are students of a certain university of England if they can pass through this room in the university, Mikshash Tuma. Why? Ki gufo shel professor eino yodi echad shehaya min yasdei universita. The body of one of the of a non-Jewish professor who was one of the founders of the university is in a big, you know, case there. And so he has a whole tshuva. Let's say you're a student, a kohen at university college, and you have to keep walking past there because, or you have classes in that room. Do you have to withdraw from the university? So he rules that no, you can remain there. And the main reason is because Meis Nachri, we can rely on the standard view that it's not Das HaPoskim, that the dead non-Jews, Inam Atami Boel. And then he gives a couple other reasons. He wants to say that Jeremy Bentham, he's behind glass. So maybe if he tries to argue that because he's sealed in the glass there, maybe that also helps with the tumah. So, and it can't be opened. So he has different arguments, but, Jeremy Bentham, created a tshuva. So there you go. I'll get back to, sorry, Joel, I'll get back to, the Tzorba Mirabbanan, what they say about the Rav and girls learning Talmud, Gemara or Torah Shebaal Peh next time, hopefully, but I see it's already time to continue. So let's move on. We are, we're in the book of letters, the last letter dealing with religious Zionism, page 228 from 1967, July. So July, that's the country, Israel was in a very euphoric state right after the Six-Day War. And this woman, Miriam Shiloh, she writes to the Rav. And we don't have her letter, but we could see from the Rav's reply, he's saying, you're a Zionist. You wrote Kol Dodu Dafek. We all studied this. How is it that you're not coming to Eretz Yisrael? Now, there's been so much said and written about Rav Soloveitchik not going to Israel, and we're not dealing with something a few hundred years ago. I mean, you can ask his daughter and her son, but it is Tova is given a number of talks dealing with her father. You can ask her, why didn't your parents or why didn't your father come to Israel? And there'll be all sorts of good reasons. Maybe her mother was ill and whatever it is. And then you find other reasons. Nothing really is very satisfying. Because at the end of the day, what about the 1950s? In the 1950s, all the RCA Mizrahi rabbis were going to Israel. They had huge tours. You know, they all went to Israel. The Rav didn't go. In the 60s, he didn't go. Then his wife was ill, so he couldn't go. And after she passed away, he didn't go. They built Gruss in Jerusalem. Gruss was built for Rabbi Soloveitchik. The whole idea was he was supposed to come for one semester and one semester be a YU. Joseph Gruss was very upset when the Rav backed out about the, you know, and the Rav has grandchildren there. So, and his daughter's there. So, you know, people say, well, he didn't want to get up his cousins, you know, the Briskers upset because if he went there, he'd have to be a Zionist. Hegel Shalmo, they put in the Cherem. You have all these reasons. I don't know. We're going to see what the Rav says. And I guess you can put them all together and maybe that'll be, maybe there isn't one reason. The Rav isn't the only one. Dr. Belkin never went. Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weinberg never went. He's closer. He's in Switzerland. What, 5 hours? They sent him an airline ticket. Ramosha Feinstein. He went, but he went pre-67. From our standpoint, I think we'd find it hard to understand how someone wouldn't feel they want to go to the Kotel. It's hard to understand why people, especially a Zionist, the head of Mizrahi. So she writes to the Rav asking about this, and he says, well, it was hard for me to reply. I think actually she might have written to him before Six-Day War, because she said it was hard for me to write because I was in Avelos for my wife. My world collapsed. I was destroyed. He says to her, I thank you for your words and accept your rebuke willingly. So she must have somehow given, I don't know, Chas v'Shalom, I think to say she rebuked him, but a strong question. He says, I sinned against the Holy Land. I am among those who've fallen back by not coming there. He says there were many factors that prevented me. He says, I'm not giving an excuse. I'm not justifying it. He says, last year, my wife and I planned to come for about 6 months. That was the whole plan, that he was supposed to go and give shiur there. But he says, many are plans in a man's heart. You know, that's what Mishle says. And you plan, and it didn't happen. Then he says, you know, many people have urged me to come. I have many students and acquaintances. He doesn't really have an answer. He says, now I can't go because I'm despondent and I'm embittered. And how can I go to Israel in such a mood? He says, it's true. I teach here. I teach Torah. And, you know, I'm educating students who are from everywhere. So he obviously knows he has a great influence, but he doesn't really, he doesn't really give a good answer other than saying, throwing his hands up almost and saying, you're right. I've sinned against the land. I should have come. Maybe he's thinking he should have come in the 50s when he could have come to see it, or the early 60s. He doesn't really have an answer. And I'd love to know what his daughter has to say. Like, why didn't he? He didn't feel the pull. All the other Mizrahi rabbis, you can go down the list, the leaders of Mizrahi. Now, the Rav is the leader of Mizrahi, but he's like a leader of Mizrahi, but he doesn't, I never get the sense that he really feels it the way they do, because he's an ish halacha. Emotion doesn't control him. So, he's not one who emotionally is going to be drawn, say, you have to go. It's, halacha drives him. But all the other Mizrahi people, immediately, from beginning in 49, they started going on boats and then later on planes. It was such a big deal. RCA had huge, tours there. The idea of returning to see a Jewish land, I don't know. With the Rav, he wasn't, pulled emotionally in that way. And that's the end of the letters dealing with, actually, no, he has a couple more, sorry, dealing with religious Zionism. On page 231, 232, not a big deal. He just, Shlomo Zalman Shragai, big Mizrahi person, and he was the first mayor of Jerusalem when Israel became a state, first or second, I think first mayor. And the Rav was quoted as offering a liberal position. And we don't know what this position is. Something about giving back land, no doubt. We're going to see what the Rav says in a minute. And the Rav says to him, I'm not going to deal with my personal opinions on this. I only tell you, he says, I never declared any opinion of what Jews should do in the land of Israel. Only Jews who live in Israel can make this decision. And that's true. The Rav never said that in Israel they should hold on to land or give back land. He never expressed such an opinion. And he was misquoted as saying that his opinion was that Jews should give back land for peace. He never said that. What he did say, and we're going to see him again, he said it in public at a Mizrahi or RCA, I can't remember now, convention. He said it in print. We're going to see now in a letter. He was quoted as saying numerous times, he said something different. He said, if the Israeli government decides to give back land, then that is halachically appropriate. There's nothing halachically wrong with that. He wasn't saying they should. He simply was saying that, and this was in response to people like Rav Yehuda Cook and Rav Gorin and others, saying that it's usher to give back land. It's forbidden to give back land. It's that which the Rav challenged. And by the way, he said the exact same thing that his nemesis, his adversary, not his adversary, I should say, but Rav Shach, Rav Shach viewed the Rav as a nemesis, adversary of sorts, and he spoke against the Rav. The Rav never spoke against Rav Shach, but Rav Shach said the exact same thing that, you know, it's all security determination. If they think that it's going to help Israel's security by giving back, then, and we'll see what the Rav says in a minute. On page 233 and on, we have here an interview that the Rav gave to Maariv, the newspaper. The Rav gave a number of newspapers, and most of it is just same sort of stuff we've seen about the value of Israel, about the anti-Semites, and but I do want to call your attention to two things. First of all, he says that there are many who write and publicize letters saying that the government should not compromise even one centimeter. That is, people saying that there's a halacha that you cannot give back land. And the Rav says that they don't take into account that through lack of compromise, we may pay a heavy price. He's not saying you should, but he's saying that this is a, when there's a choice, one must consider the lives of human beings. As Rav Gorin's position and others was that this is halacha, like any other halacha. It's a Bahamas mitzvah, and Bahamas, even if you tell me that lives are going to be lost. Look, today I think we realize you can give back all the land you want. It doesn't seem to change anything. Because they want occupied Palestine, and that's not the occupied territories. That's Tel Aviv. That's Haifa. That's the settlers in Sderot, as they call them. So, it's not, you know, it's not about the occupation that caused what we saw last week. It's about the existence of Israel. Okay. Maybe they'll become a more moderate Palestinian element and, through peace, giving back certain areas in Yehuda and Sharon, could reach a peace. And, that was what the Rav in this interview in 75 was speaking about. And the Rav says this must be considered. Again, he's not saying that this is what you should do. He says you need to consider. And he goes on and says that when it comes to these matters, when it comes to the issues of territory, the quote, the experts are the chief of staff and the leadership of the Israel Defense Forces and the government of Israel. If they will conclude that it's possible to compromise over territory without threatening the life of the Yishuv and the existence of the state, we should rely on them. That's also what Rav Avad Yosef said, that these are, this is not a halachic issue whatsoever. And I find it a little curious, I have to admit it, that in Rav Schechter's books, three books dealing with the Rav, including Nefesh HaRav, which has an entire chapter in Eretz Yisrael, there is nothing about this position of the Rav, which was expressed publicly on a number of occasions, namely that if you wish to give back, if the government wants to give back land, if they think it's it'll save lives, that they can. There's no halachic problem with it. I'm thinking, because Rav Schechter probably opposes this, he didn't want to include it, because then he might have to offer his own view, and that might be seen as disrespectful. But it is striking, it's not there. That's the Rav's position, and he adds something else. A famous story, the story is also quoted by Rabbi Dov Katz in one of his books. The story goes as follows, and I'm assuming it's a true story because the Rav quotes it, and Dov Katz quotes it independently of the Rav. The Rav Chaim was living in Minsk at the end of World War I, and there was a series of pogroms against the Jews in that area, and one day he says that people were discussing the murders and destruction, and one Jew said, if only we knew that this suffering was the birth pangs of the Messiah. That is, if this was the Messiah, the birth, you know, we know that the time before Mashiach is said to be full of difficulties and problems. So the person says, if only this was, you know, we knew that this was the birth pangs of the Messiah, basically then it would be worth it. But we can't be sure of it, so it's so terrible. But if it was, it's like, God forbid, let's say last week, after a terrible thing happened, someone could say, oh, if only this was Zikvas of Mashiach, then maybe we could live with this. And, but, you know, because then at least we're going to be led into Mashiach. What did Reb Chaim say? Reb Chaim said he doesn't accept such a statement. And the man said, what do you mean? What did I say wrong? And Reb Chaim said, if this is the birth pangs of the Messiah, you know, to say that it would be worth it if this was, you know, leading us into Mashiach, he says, I reject this because it goes against halacha. If the coming of Mashiach requires the shedding of any innocent blood, then I don't want the Mashiach. There are many ways to bring the redemption without the spilling of blood. So Reb Chaim's point was that human life goes before everything. And even if you're going to say, well, this is, you know, so apparently Reb Chaim rejects the whole notion of Ikvas of the Mashiach, that well, I shouldn't say he rejects it. He says it's something we don't want. If it comes, it comes. But we don't want it. And we wish we, if Mashiach is going to require shedding of life, we don't want it. In one of the books of Rabbi Eliyahu Zinni, he's the Rosh Yeshiva, very, very right-wing Rosh Yeshiva in the Yeshiva Or Vishua in Haifa. Real Hamdan, very interesting writer, but some very extreme statements. He says that, he says these words of Reb Chaim, he quotes it from Rav Dov Katz, he says, they're divrei tema. He says that they don't make any sense. He says they contradict the entire notion of Milchama, Milchama's mitzvah, and certainly Milchama's rishos. He says if we would accept what Reb Chaim says, we have to say that it was forbidden for us to conquer Eretz Yisrael in the days of Yoshua, because that was going to lead to death, and we'd better to remain in the Midbar. He says, Asur lahamin shegadol b'Yisrael amar davar kazeh. Rav Zinni falls back on what people always say when they can't accept something. It's forbidden to, we can't believe it was ever said. You know how they always say things. If they don't like what's said, they say what's written, they say a Talmid Torah, a erring student put it in. If they don't like what they heard, they said he never could have said that. It's forbidden to believe he could have said that. But we know he did say that. He said that, he says, this is the time of the Rogling. You're going to say Reb Chaim said this? This is what the Meraglim said. The Meraglim said that it's a land that eats the inhabitants. And if we accept this, he said, what Reb Chaim is quoted as saying, we should have just remained in Egypt, because leaving Egypt led to death. So he says, you can't accept this. And he says, Godol k'Reb Chaim mibrisk lo yomar. He would never say divrei hevel ke'eva. And Baruch Chaim did say that. And now, look, what about Mechames Mitzvah? I think it's clear that Reb Chaim obviously acknowledged that in a Mechames Mitzvah, the people would die. But that's why it's a Mechames Mitzvah. But Reb Chaim is not choosing it. It's a mitzvah. You have to do it. And therefore, some are going to die. You can't have conscientious objection, but it is hard for me to imagine how Reb Chaim would have ever been able to support the Mechames Rishos. I guess you say the Urim V'Tumim, so it's really comes from divine, but you know, the idea that the whole idea of Mechames Rishos to expand territory, I don't know. Okay, let's go on. Next, about the end of this letter, he says, he's asked, do you steer your students to Aliyah? And he says, of course we steer them in that direction. I don't know, who's the Rav certainly didn't steer it. Maybe why you did. He says, many of my students at Yeshiva Sefer Zichron have made Aliyah. Among my students, includes my daughter, my son-in-law, my only son. I've never heard that the Rav encouraged it. The Rav's attitude was, if you can grow more in your Judaism there, you should go there. But every person has to make an individual decision. And then the Rav says, finally, he's asked, do you consider yourself a Zionist? Remember, we saw all these letters where the Rav had to reply to people who said, and these letters were from the 60s, but it continued throughout the 70s, these suspicions that people wondered. They wrote to the Rav, Rebbe, have you abandoned Mizrahi? And the Rav has to write these back letters back. No, I'm a big Mizrahi person. I still believe in Mizrahi. Mizrahi is the most important movement to in Eretz Yisrael. Why were people always writing to the Rav? Because he had a habit of saying things that led them to question his commitment. So, for example, in this interview, he's asked, do you consider yourself a Zionist? And he says, if Zionism refers to a technical concept or to belonging to some established body, then I am not part of it, though I am formally a member of Mizrahi and pay dues. In other words, here he's saying that if Zionist means you belong to a religious Zionist party, he says, and I'm not a Zionist, even though I'm formally a member of Mizrahi, but that's basically saying I'm not really into this whole thing. I'm a member of Mizrahi, I pay dues. So you could see how anyone reading this would say, that's your feeling about Mizrahi? Then he continues, if, however, Zionism is love for the Jewish people and devotion to Eretz Yisrael, Then I'm certainly a Zionist. He says that with my father as a youth, I studied the areas of Zerillion, Hilchos Trumos of Maestros, Matanos and Mataniim, Matnos Aniim, Ubikurim. Okay, so the Rav is saying, of course I'm a Zionist. I love Eretz Yisrael. I learned all the halachas backwards and forwards. The problem is that's not what it means to be a Zionist. And the Rav knows that. A Zionist means a political Zionist. And a religious Zionist is one who's involved in the political program. The most Haredi person studies Hilchos Matnos Aniim and Hilchos Trumos Maestros. So a passage like this, so I love Eretz Yisrael. Who doesn't love Eretz Yisrael? This is the sort of passage that people started getting worried that the Rav really isn't committed to the Mizrahi ideology. Because to be a Mizrahi person, it's a lot more than saying I love Eretz Yisrael. Every Agudist loves Eretz Yisrael also. But no one's going to call them a Tzioni. They love Eretz Yisrael. Being a Zionist means something else. So at times the Rav waxes eloquent on what it means to be a religious Zionism. The most powerful religious Zionist statements, be it in Kol Dodi Dofei or the Chamesh Drashot or in some of the letters stuff I already read you. I mean, you can't get any more profound in what the state of Israel means. And that sometimes in the Rav thinking aloud, in here, in this interview, you see it's really very lukewarm. It's what I've often said. You could take the man out of brisk, but you can't take brisk out of the man. Brisk raises its head sometimes, and the Rav falls back on Zionism as just Yishuv Eretz Yisrael and the mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz. But that is lukewarm political Zionism at best. But there he says it. And the last letter in the book, dealing with, in this section, deals with his connection to the Mizrahi. And he says, "I returned to the Mizrahi." This is in 77. I don't know what it means that he left the Mizrahi. He never officially left it. But then again, he says that there's no one like Mizrahi when it comes to education. He says this doesn't mean I concur with all the Gush Emunim ideology. I do not. He says, Pikuach Nefesh is more important than Mesiras Nefesh. The Gush Emunim people have Mesiras Nefesh. They settle all the different places of land. They live in caravans. They do all this thing. They're not concerned about the danger because they're redeeming the land. It's Mesiras Nefesh. But the Rav says, Pikuach Nefesh is more important than Mesiras Nefesh. So you see, the Rav thinks it's better. He doesn't think you can endanger yourself living out in the middle of nowhere, surrounded by, enemy Arabs, enemy Arab populations. So this letter, he talks about the law of return. He says it must be changed to say that you have to be the Lubavitch Rebbe was big on this. It never was changed in the end, a Jew is the one who's converted according to Halacha. That never was changed. And to this day, it hasn't been changed. So anyone is eligible. It doesn't matter if you're converted, unless you're converted by an Orthodox rabbi. I mentioned this before. If you're converted by a Reform rabbi or Conservative rabbi, you are eligible for the law of return. When you won't be able to marry, because that's the Rabbanu, but you're eligible for the law of return. If you are converted by an Orthodox rabbi, well, you have to be only certain Orthodox rabbis. If you're converted by someone, an Orthodox rabbi, who's not on the chief rabbinate's approved list, you are not eligible for the law of return. Sound crazy? Sound insane? Well, it is, but that's the, because when it came to the Orthodox rabbis, the Israeli government, they said, we need to find out who a real rabbi is, because otherwise you can have all these people converting, fake conversions to enter Israel. All of Sudan would convert. So what do? They turn to the chief rabbinate, and the chief rabbinate can tell who real Orthodox rabbis are. And they decided that certain Orthodox rabbis are not real Orthodox rabbis, and the conversions are not valid. But if they convert by conservative or reform, they can't go to the chief rabbinate. So instead, they turn to the conservative rabbinical assembly and the reform rabbinical movement. And they affirm that these are rabbis in good standing. So it's quite ironic, as I said, that Orthodox rabbinic conversions are not accepted for the law of return unless you're on the list. And that excludes a number of people, including RCA rabbis, and conservative and reform are on the list. Okay, now we're going to go quickly. We have We have 20 more minutes. We have in the book only another 90 pages, but a lot of this we've already seen. So, for example, we're in part 5 of the book, Interreligious Affairs. A lot of stuff here about Jewish participation in Vatican II, the Rav statements. We went through all this. I don't need to repeat it. The one interesting point that he mentions in this is that there were Jews who wanted, in the Ecumenical Council of Vatican II, the one that dealt with Jews, the place of the Jews, Nostra Aetate is what the document that came out in 64, which changed the Catholics' view of the Jews. But there were Jewish Jews who wanted to be part of this, that is, be part of the deliberations. And the Rav is so opposed to this. This idea, he thinks, is completely out of line, that we don't participate in non-Jewish religious discussions. If they want to remove the charge of deicide from us, deicide meaning killing of God, okay, we'll be very happy they do that. That caused a lot of murder in the past. But we're not going to get involved in their internal disputes and issues, just like they're not coming into our internal issues. And at the end of the day, whether they consider us killers of God or not, you know, that's really neither here nor there as far as we're concerned. We don't need to go kiss up to them and beg them to, oh, please take us off this. You know, we didn't do this. That's something they're going to do, and that has to be their role. And if they're going to do the right thing, they'll take it away, and maybe this will create a better day. But we can't be involved in their religious affairs. And that goes on for about 50 pages here, dealing with... And the last letter in this section, page 267, was written to Rabbi Pesach Lovitz in 1967, who had asked, he was the president of the RCA, can the RCA, this is a rabbinical organization, participate in an interreligious conference? So I mentioned Rabbi Wurzburger, for we know that the Rav trusted Rabbi Wurzburger, so he allowed him to have certain interreligious discussions. But here it's different to have a rabbinical organization. And the Rav is opposed to it. He thinks that it's futile. It's going to damage the religious communities, our religious community. It would result in an attempt, conscious or unconscious, of one community to impose its theology on the other. That is, when you get together and you start talking theologically, people start feeling embarrassed. Well, maybe our view doesn't make the other side feel good, and there's pressure to change it, and the Rav wants to keep apart from this. He says there should be no discussion of theological problems which will only cause embarrassment and inflict untold harm on the good relationship between our two communities. From the Rav standpoint, why do we need to get together? We get together to talk about how to make the world a safer place, how to make sure that children... you know, or have food to eat, that the government looks out for religion, and all these generalities. And we're supposed to get together and talk with Catholics, and that's really who it is we're dealing with in the 60s, to talk about all the different our theologies. The Catholics want to create a theology of the Jew, and you have Jews that create a theology of the Catholic Church. And there have been people, including some well-known people in recent years, who've tried to create a new theology of Christianity, and because the argument that Christians today, they have a different view. Okay, all these sorts of things that the Rav was opposed to, if the new evaluation was coming from pressure, what it was thought to be pressure from the outside world, that we have to update, as it were, our theology. And he says, of course, we want to be together with these non-Jews in fields of social legislation, joint action, discussion of humanitarian, social and moral problems in terms of universal humanitarian and religious categories, but not theological discussions. Okay, so that takes us to the end. And now we are the last section of the book. The last section of the book, Rabbi Helfgott titles it, Torah, Philosophical, and Personal Insights. And there really is no theme, overriding theme here. It's just a group of letters which had to be put in this area because they have all different themes. So you have a letter on Jewish philosophy to Rabbi Leo Young. You have a letter to Rabbi Rachman. It doesn't give on page 273 who the correspondent is, an unknown correspondent, but we know it's Rabbi Rachman. I dealt with this letter in the past. It deals with the nature of halakha. I dealt with it a few weeks ago. A few letters to Simon Ravidovitz. Simon Ravidovitz, the father of Benjamin Ravid, professor emeritus at Brandeis. He also was at Brandeis, Ravidovitz. He came in the 50s, and he died young. He was an expert in Jewish philosophy and Nachman Krochmal and the Rambam, and he wrote a good deal. And living in Boston, he, of course, knew the Rav, and he or the Boston area. And you have a few letters from the Rav to him dealing with issues in the Rambam. Ravidovitz not only published articles, he published an edition of Hilchos Deos, I think. Just or no, Sefer Mada. No, I just think Hilchos Deos of I forget now, but it might be the whole Sefer Mada, the first volume. And so the Rav, of course, writes to him with his ideas. Then you have on page 289 a letter written to a Rav named Moshe Dov Ber Rifkin. He was Rosh Yeshiva at Torah Vadas, but he also was a Chabad Chassid, a prominent Chabad Chassid, and he was very friendly with the Rav. The Rav wrote, did a hesped for him. This appeared about a year ago in Chakira. They discovered, or the family had it, the hesped of the Rav, when it was published. So this letter is of interest because the Rav speaks of what he calls, page 289, a special fondness for the Lubavitch movement. In my next blog post, these classes encourage me to do some of this stuff, put together some of the stuff I know about the Rav in written form. So it's not just you people listening to it who get it, it's other people. But there is a thing which I didn't mention to you. I think maybe the first publication of the Rav appears in a Chabad publication. The Rav had a connection to Chabad. There's a famous picture of him in Boston together with the Rebbe Rayatz and the Lubavitcher Rebbe, Rav Menachem Mendel, and they're all sitting down. As I recall, it's in Boston. It's not in New York. It's in Boston, that picture. The Rav always had a connection to Chabad, and we'll see what he says, where he got this connection from. If you want to see another example of this, take a look at the video. You can see it online, Rebbe's Farm Rangin, where the Rav came to it. The Chabad put it out because they interviewed Rabbi Herschel Schachter, that's J.G. Schachter's son, father. Herschel Schachter brought the Rav there and he interviewed him. But you could see the video. The Rebbe stands up for the Rav, and the Rav stays at the Farm Rangin for a good deal of time. And so they had a strong connection. They published a volume in honor of the Rav. The students did it in the 70s, early 80s, and they asked the Rebbe for a contribution. They write some letter, a short letter, saying that, they write to him that we know about your close friendship with the Rav, and he writes back that more than you know. That is, remember, the Rebbe and the Rav were together, both children of royalty, together in Berlin at the same time. Their contact in person was extremely limited from the time they came to America. You can probably count on one hand the times they saw each other. Maybe some shiva, when the Rebbe became Rebbe, when the Rav's sitting shiva, he doesn't come to a shiva, he sends his people. I don't know, other than the Farm Bringen, I don't know any other times in really, since the Rebbe became Rebbe, that they were together in person. I think there's one, maybe, or two, but they didn't really see each other. But it's like the Rav also said it once: with certain friends, you don't need to see them, but you communicate in other ways, and they were very close. So where does he get his special fondness for Chabad? And the Rav, he loved Tanya. One summer in the, he used to have a kollel. They used to come in the summer, and Rabbi Kanak wrote about this. He decided to teach Tanya to them in the summer, and the students were not so happy that they didn't want to learn Tanya. But the Rav was very connected to it. He says, "I recall visions of my youth, paved with the pure impressions of childhood, enveloped by romantic splendor. patriarchal images still hover over me. What is he referring to? The likeness of my mentor, Baruch Yaakov Reisberg. He had a Chabad, he was in a Chabad town, Klasovich, and he had a Chabad Muhammad. So Chabad Muhammad wasn't doing such a good job as far as Ramosha was concerned, because he's, Ramosha comes to the Rav after a few weeks. He wants to review Gemara, and the Rav doesn't know any Gemara. The Muhammad was teaching him Tanya, and Ramosha was very upset that, but the Rav was very influenced by this Muhammad. And believe it or not, when YU students went to Russia in the 70s with student struggle, I think, for Soviet Jewry, lo and behold, they met the Rav's Muhammad was still alive. And I think this was the early 70s. And they came back, and the Rav couldn't believe it. He said, impossible. Is it? Could it be? Could it be? It was. The Rav's Muhammad was still alive, obviously, in his 90s or something. So the Rav was very much influenced. And it's not just his Rebbe. And he says, my eyes still perceive the portrait of the Tzemach Tzedek. You know, he grew up in a town that was a Chabad town. Now, how is it that Ramosha Soloveitchik was Rav of Chasovich, a Chabad town? So there's a whole story there about why the town, it goes back to the Napoleonic Wars, why they decided to only hire a Misnagid as the Rav, as a Misnagid Rabbi Seib or Shneur Zalman. I forget the exact details. But this was a city of Chabad, and that's where he had his early years, and he understood what it meant, Hasidus. I encountered Hasidic passion with emotional excitement. It's, he goes on and on and on. And then he says to Ramosha, see, Ramosha Rifkin, he feels connected to Ramosha Rifkin. Ramosha Rifkin is a London, but he's also a Hasid. So he has the quality of being able to analyze a sugya, to be a London, to make distinctions, to be intellectual. But he also is a chassid, so he also has that emotional pull. And the Rav says, he says, you know, that's me too. I have this, the halachic rigor and the chassidic joy that, you know, he has the halachic rigor and chassidic joy that, Rabbi Rifkin has. And he points out something interesting. Rabbi Rifkin in, his sefer talks about, the issue of kohanim. Can Kohanim go to the grave of a tzaddik? On the one hand, he says, the posek, the lamdan, the answer is no. A Kohen can't be metame to anyone. On the other hand, as he says, the Hasidic personality desires to be lenient in this issue. And we know that in the Hasidic world, this was a practice that they would go to, they did, because tzaddikim and metamim. So he says that... he says to him, this schism that between thought and feeling that he says Rav Rifkin has, on the one hand, you're a chassid, you want to be lenient on this man. On the other hand, you know the sources. He says, this sunders my soul as well. At times, I tend to listen to the murmur of my heart. A strand of chassidut is buried deep within me. So the Rav is telling us, everyone, people think of the Rav as, if you read Halachic Man, it's pure intellect. It's like Spock, you know, that the Vulcan. It's just halacha. But as we've said already, that halachic man is, it's like economic man. It's not an actual real life portrait. It's a theoretical portrait. But that's not the Rav. And we already saw that even halacha, the Rav says that subjective factors push him in different directions. And here he says that he has emotion. And he's not just the ish halacha. He's not just the one who's looking at it like a, you know, an intellectual, purely intellectual, logical personality. He also has the emotion. He's torn between both worlds. And that's, people who've written on the Rav have made this point that you can't only look to the intellectual and you can't only look to the emotional. The Rav was someone very powerfully, you know, including both of them inside him. Okay, I see we've already come to the, we have only, let's see, only 40 pages or so. I don't know if next class or class after, not, we're coming to the end. So I think we've done 20 classes. I'm not finishing up any sooner than we should, but for those who love the Rav, you could probably do another 10 classes, 20 classes. But some people, I think, already feel, okay, we've done a lot of the Rav. It's time to move on. But as those who've been with me know, that the Rav is often a jumping off place for all sorts of issues we deal with. And I have to say that the Rav is the sort of person that you know, other figures I wouldn't spend that long with, but the Rav is he's so powerful that I'm not going to apologize for us in the end doing 22 or 23 classes on the Rav. So let me take the comments and questions here now. Okay, we hear that Biden is going to Israel. Okay, I don't want to get political. I'll just say I think this is a non-political statement. His speech, it was incredible. Biden's speech. Look, Biden is from the old liberals, and the Democratic Party still had liberals who loved Israel and believed in supporting it. Halavai, that we still have some, Richie Torres and others, but if you live in the New York area, you know that unfortunately it's a problem because many of them don't. So thank you for that. That's great. Morty says he thinks that in MTL at Shomrim Laboker, I guess they don't duchen on Shabbos. I don't know. And Marty says Chabad doesn't duchen on Shabbos. Okay, that I didn't know.
That's
Chabad
not
doesn't
true.
Duchen on Shabbos?
That's not true.
It's not true?
They do duchen on Shabbos.
Okay, so now we have a machokas, but we heard that I've never heard it, and so we hear they do duchen on Shabbos. We have Chabad people, by the way, who are with us, not live, but Mark says, you got to wonder if the mistaken extension of practice of not saying Hatavas Chalom, you said that last class. Maybe, I don't know. All the people who deal with this are left dumbfounded where this practice could have come from, because it's not a textual practice. But you know, we have lots of practices that are strange, that if you look at the textual tradition, they don't seem to fit, then you're wrong. That was Chaim Soloveitchik's whole point in his article, that what we're seeing in recent years is a return to textualism. That is what the sources say, not what the minhag was. So we have many things that people do which seem to go against the sources, and we don't know where they came from. So I have no idea where this practice came from, but I'm more interested in how it disappeared so quickly, because I read you testimony how this was, if not the dominant, although the sources I read you said it was the dominant, but let's say maybe it's an exaggeration, certainly a very, very popular practice. And as I told you, when the Rav came to Boston, that's what he found, and he fought against it, and he was unsuccessful. But I don't think there's any shul today in Boston that doesn't duchen on Shabbos. Ah, it's great. Thank you for this. I'm glad I raised it. Montreal Beth Zion doesn't duchen on Shabbos. I don't know Beth Zion. If you can write in the comments, is this a Polish synagogue? Is this a Litvish synagogue? Like, what's the minhag, the nusach? It's definitely not a German synagogue. I think I can be pretty sure of that.
The rabbi of Beth Zion was from Yeshiva Berlin, the Chaim Berlin in Baltimore.
Chaim Berlin? Okay, yeah. But you'd have to look at who started it, this shul, if these were Galicianos.
Oh, he started the shul. Rabbi Sidney Shoham started the shul in the 50s.
Okay. He started the shul. Okay, yeah. But he might have just included the minhag he grew up in. So or the shul that he grew up in.
That's possible.
We have to trace it.
Unfortunately, he's not alive anymore to ask.
Okay. And Morty says that MTL is a real Chabad shul, and they don't duchen. Okay, I don't know. Nikki says, if she remembers correctly, we never duchen on Shabbos Yom Tov until Israel was established. And the minhag became to a shortened duchening with no singing between the last two words as Donowite Yom Tov. Ah, that's interesting. Did something have to do with Israel? Nikki, yeah?
Yeah, I remember as a kid that we never duchened in our shul until after Israel. And then
what's the connection?
I don't know. I just don't remember. I suspect it was because when they were duchening every single day, and I think there was a consensus, a feeling that that maybe we should at least on Shabbos and on Yontif that falls on Shabbos. At least then we should,
I mean, it's fascinating. I'm hoping people are going to email me about, they'll tell me about, just like you said, that we remember we didn't and then it changed. Look, Israel did a lot of changed things. It seems that every single modern Orthodox shul in America today, and Canada probably, Friday night sings Yidi Nefesh. Growing up, we never sang that. In Israel, they did. Somehow, I guess in the 80s or something, it became a practice to do it. So,
and think it was a practice that started in Kibbutz Levi?
Yeah, it started in Kibbutz Levi? I didn't know
that. I think
that,
so. Uh-huh. They're responsible for Yidi Nefesh in every single pew you see now.
Zev says Chabad does Dochen, but we have his testimony, Edut Nemana, that a MTL, I don't know that shul, it's in Shomer and Boker, so unless that's a mistake, we have testimony. Now, Mel, you say, as Mark said, it has to do with tefillah. What I said is I quoted this Sefer from the 19th century who gives that as an option, as a possibility. Whether that's really the reason, I don't know. The Taz and the Magen Avraham, Magen Avraham gives a different reason. He says because the Ribon, you know, the Ribon Shol, the so-called, I don't know what you call them, the silent prayers that you have on in Birkas Kohanim, which already are a problem. You're not supposed to say them out loud. Some say you should, Art School says, just look them with your eyes. You're not supposed to say those on Shabbos. So the Magen Avraham says, well, since people stop saying duchening because of those things. Michael says, maybe Rosh Feinstein helped change the minhag. I guess because Ramosha has the tshuva saying, all these things, the Rav also, it could help, but it came very quickly. And that would be the triumph, I guess, of textualism. I don't remember the tshuva offhand, but I will check it later. Well, you're quoting it here, that Ramosha says it's an error, and you should change it. And Ramosha continues, in recent times, there's virtually no place where this is a terrible minhag is. Thank you for that. Oh, so you got it. Here you have it here. And he says, the Aruch HaShulchan says that this practice, which they used to do, has now been annulled because it has no reason. So Ramosha is probably writing, what, in the 50s or 60s? I was giving sources from the 19th century. Maybe already the early 20th century it changed. I don't know. Look, if you have the Rav students going to shuls, and you have Ramosha Feinstein students and influence going to shuls, telling people to change this minhag, I guess that could have maybe put the knife in the heart of this minhag, you know, got rid of it. But it was only after I started looking at it last week at some of the sources did I realize how significant a change this is, that this was a very, very popular minhag, which is has pretty much gone by the wayside. I didn't know this iPad that Bentham is marked for the meetings. He's marked as present, but non-voting. Okay, yeah. And Ellen says that your Hertz sitter, post 59, has the Yom Tov Musaf Amida to Birkas Hayom, and then says to continue on page 460. Well, that's what I have, but it doesn't say not to say it. It doesn't say it either. It doesn't say ever say duchening, even for Yom Tov. It just tells you to go back, and then you have to know that did the Birnbaum sitter say you duchen? It just, you have to know that it's the time to duchen. Listen said the Rav interfere with advocating for the Khan Commission. Is that Sabra Shatila? That is true, but that would be maybe the only time. The Rav threatened to leave Mizrahi if they didn't appoint a commission to investigate Sabra Shatila. Look, Menachem Begin said, Goyim kol Goyim, and they blamed the Jews. But the Rav felt that it needs to be determined. It was under Jewish control. It needs to be determined if there was any negligence of the Jews in this matter. The Rav's attitude is that we have to be, we can't be like everyone else. We have to be beyond.
Didn't
right.
the Israeli the commissioner at home conclude that the army had permitted things they ought not have permitted?
Well, it's a big rebuke for Sharon. If that's his Khan commission is Sabra Shatila?
I don't remember which was which anymore, but that's
a story. I don't know, but the Sabra Shatil Commission did conclude that Sharon was negligent, that he should have known that letting these Falangists in to the refugee camp would lead to what it led to.
That sounds a little more generous.
And privately, someone says that one of Shabtai Tzvi's innovations was into Birkas Kohanim on every Shabbos, even non-Yom Tov. Perhaps as a reaction to this, some communities ceased this practice on any Shabbos. Ah, that's interesting. We know that Shabtai Tzvi instituted this, and it continues to this day in Shabtai Tzvi, I mean, his followers instituted in Amsterdam, in the main Sephardic show in Amsterdam. It continues to this day. Yaakov Sasportas, in his volume of Chufos, deals with this. And then the question was, what about people who instituted Birkas Kohanim? Do they stop it? If you go to Gerba, they only do Duchening on Shabbos, not during the week, even though they're Sephardim. Is that from a Sabbatian influence? I don't know. So are you saying, is this a reaction that they stopped the practice on any Shabbos? I never thought of it, but it's as good an answer as any of the ones we've seen. Look at the Taz. I don't know, because the Taz already, the Taz is the same time as Shabtai Tzvi. The Taz even wrote a letter to him. And the Taz already speaks about this as a practice of not saying it. So that would have made too soon, because the Taz is during the Shabtai Tzvi period, and you wouldn't have people, I don't think, unless it was, I don't think it works out time-wise enough for it to have become a popular practice already in the days of the Taz, if people were doing it against Shabtai Tzvi. I don't know. Someone also points out that the Rav paid a condolence visit to the Rebbe after the Schneerson family after the passing of the Rayatz. Yeah, that's before he's a Rebbe. You know, after there's a bit of a power struggle between the Gerari supporters and Rav Nachum Mendel supporters. I'm trying to figure out, some Chabadnik is going to have to, Rav Shemaria will have to tell me, did the Rav, before the Farm Rengen, did the Rav ever meet in person with the Rebbe? They obviously communicated, but after the Rebbe became Rebbe, was there ever a personal meeting between the Rav and the Rebbe? I'd love to know that. Yes, Rabbi Wurzburg was Rabbi Shari Sharmaim in Toronto as well as also in Shari Tefillah in New York. Yes, Nissen, we know this of Shita, Ruchaim Cohen, that he would have attended to Rabbeinu Tam's burial. And Minhag Yerushalayim was that Kohanim went to Kevaracha. So we know this is a practice. But it's very schwer, as they say, difficult if you look at the mainstream halachic sources. So what the Rav was saying is that you, as a chassid, on the one hand, your emotional side wants to draw you to that, because how could the Rebbe be tummy? But on the other hand, you look at the halachic sources, it's hard to reach that.
Dr. Chappell didn't do it.
So someone says here that... Oh, sorry, yes?
I remember the Rav and Rabbi Schneider knew each other at the University of Berlin in the 30s, is that true?
Well, yeah, they were together in the 30s. But my question is, and the Rav says, you know, he was very friendly with him. You don't need to be in communication with someone. You have good friend from your youth, your teen years, your early 20s. You don't see them for 30 years, but you still feel they're your friend. But my question is, I'd love to know, did they ever get together in person after that? Someone says, M.H. Lazerson, he often attends Chabad services. They never duchen on a normal Shabbos. The one exception is in Rome, they do. So here we have, look, we have someone saying that Chabad does duchen on Shabbos, but here we have people who attend Chabad services and they don't duchen. I think we got to get to the bottom of what the Chabad minhag is, because I don't think Chabad is that... generally, that different places do different things. And Zev says they don't duchen on normal Shabbos, but do duchen on Yom Tov, which falls on Shabbos. So, M.H. Lazerson, are you referring to regular Shabbos? Because Chabad won't duchen on Shabbos. They're Ashkenazim. They only duchen on Yom Tov. The question is, so now we have testimony, they do duchen on Yom Tov. Okay. If anyone has anything else, you can let me know. Rabbi Shudnow says Yisker wasn't recited on Shabbos at JTS. That's interesting. I don't know what the background for that is. And Ellen says that Birnbaum Siddur mentions Duchening. I guess that's your point saying it. I think probably, Ellen, that's what I showed you online. The person meant when he said that Hertz Chumash also, Hertz Seder also doesn't mention Duchening on Shabbos, but it doesn't mention Duchening at all. It just says go back, and then you have Elkeinu Elkeinu. In England, there was a problem with Duchening. There were shuls, so-called Orthodox shuls, that abolished Duchening. I can't explain it. I can explain it. I don't understand the sentiment. They thought it was undignified. I'm talking in the late, early 20th century, these English sort of super formal synagogues. There were a couple that got rid of Duchening, and they thought it was not dignified.
But they took off their shoes. That sounds like a very... I could imagine English people thinking that was very...
Ah, so you say not to take off the shoes. Is that the reason? That could be the reason. I always thought it just looked like voodoo or superstition. You put the talus over your head, do this. You know that in the Syrian community, they don't take their shoes off. They duchen with shoes on. But that could be the reason, Alan. I always wondered about that. Maybe it's because taking off your shoes, that's what they thought is undignified. Very good point. Thank you very much. Okay, Rabbi Kelman.
Okay, very interesting. Yes, all the minhagim, various minhagim back and forth. Okay.
Rabbi Kelman?
I'm sorry?
Have you ever seen this? Have you ever seen in Toronto? Not duchening on Shabbos?
Probably. I for sure am aware of such a minhag. I'm trying to remember when I saw it. Absolutely, for sure. There's a minhag many places. I think more in a lot of the shtiblach, whatever, they did not do. And by the way, another minhag is these places don't read Ruth, Kohelet, or Shir or Shirim. I have lots of shuls that didn't read it. And
is that a minhag? I just thought that they didn't have the patience. And they said,
well, whatever. So, like, it's interesting. Marty was talking before how Rabbi Wurzberger was, you know, in Toronto when I was a little kid. I don't remember him when he was years in Toronto. But I know when Mark Drach was in Toronto, they were not reading Shir Shim, in Shir Shemaim. They weren't reading the Megillot. So he told me he introduced, like, they would do a perek. Like, they would read one perek and go, Alad. And I think now they do the whole thing. But it's interesting. Growing up, a lot of shuls did not read Megillot. And for sure, Yedid Nefesh, that's another interesting one. Yeah, but for sure, I can see the Israel influence that, you know, that what Dr. Katz was saying, that when Israel, you know, that influenced us to Dukin. That makes a lot of sense, for sure. Because they're Dukining twice on Shabbos. So what's the issue to Dukin on Shabbos? Anyways, okay. It's always interesting. All right, like I say, we should hear good news. That's the most important thing. That's
some MH lasers that says Chabad don't read the Megillus.
Yeah, okay, yeah. There you go. Even today. Yeah. That would not surprising.
When my husband and his brother are Kahanim, and when they were sitting Shiva for their father, the one was in Israel, the older one was in Israel, and my husband was in New York. And the older brother was duchening every day in Shiva. And here, it was such tension between them what to do. And so I really believe the minhagim of Israel was what switched it very rapidly. I mean, that condensed it.
I mean, that's the reason they give, I think, in the Ramah, why we don't duchen every day. There's a whole question, why don't we duchen every day in Chutz Laaretz? And
right.
It's with the Velis, and then Israel, there's more Simcha, closer to a Kaddish Baruch Hu. So, yeah, it's very interesting, very interesting. And, okay, thank you. Okay, thank you for that. Tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman at 1 o'clock, continuing on Kohelet. Wednesday at 10 a.m., Simi Peters is going to begin her, I think, 10-part series on Yaakov and Esav, do a sort of an in-depth study. Yaakov and Esav, she's taught in the course a number of times, so that will be this week. And our parsha this week, Rabbi David Harbater, he was supposed to be in America, but he will be in Israel and getting up at 3 o'clock in the morning to give the shiur. And, okay, our learning should be a scoot for all of us, for both Klal Yisrael and Eretz Yisrael. We should hear good things. And, okay, everybody, Laila Tov, be well. And, thank you very much. Okay. Good night.
Good night, Rabbi, and Laila Tov.